Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Jeff Madrick, editor of Challenge magazine and director of policy research at the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis at the New School in New York. Jeff and I met at the American Economic Association's annual meetings in San Francisco in 2009, where we spoke about his new book, The Case for Big Government, published by Princeton University Press. I began by putting it to Jeff that from a European perspective, a book published with this title in the United States seemed like seditious literature.
Well, 9 months ago now, when it was put to bed, it was still a seditious idea. The credit crisis, the recession has made it clear to people that government is needed. But I've always been disturbed by this. I've thought we've been living in America in a kind of dark ages, consumed by an anti-government ideology that was not based in fact or evidence, but in faith. And I think in anger. The anger grew out of the difficult economic times of the 1970s, and also a bit of anger with the errant ways of government, Watergate, the excesses of the Vietnam War, and so forth. But it got carried very far, and government became the problem in America, not business, not the American people, not the education system, although all of those were blamed at some point or other. Government became the problem. And I think that ideology has hurt the American economy very badly, and I wanted to bring the case up front and forward. The point is, government has always been essential for America, for its prosperity, for its equity, and maybe least recognized, but equally important, as an agent of change. Because societies change, economies change, needs change, our knowledge changes, and government is essential in helping us adapt to that, creating new institutions, new laws, new ways of helping us cope with these kinds of changes.
And Jeff, you think the whole anti-government rhetoric that has so dominated American society for so long, that's really come out of a serious misreading of American history?
Serious misreading of American history. Government was always integral to the economy, to our prosperity, to our social equity, and so forth. We never really had a laissez-faire America, a laissez-faire government. Now, in modern times, we measure government as a government spending as a proportion of the whole economy. But that's a modern construction. In the old days, though, when government was relatively small in terms of how much it spent, there was a lot of regulation. Regulation over land, regulation over products, and so forth. But government also built the canals, subsidized the railroad through land donations, built free primary schools, then high schools, then the land-grant universities in the second half of the 1800s, again built on land donations. That was a form of government spending. It was integral to our lives then, and in later years, clearly integral to our lives, building roads, highways, high schools, as I say, colleges, and health systems, sanitation, sewage, making the cities possible, and more, regulation, keeping the markets working.
Now, the standard arguments against government, particularly powerful in this country, are things about the problem of high taxation, creating disincentives for people to work and invest, things about regulations driving people to behave in undesirable ways, And all the issues about government kind of crowding out private sector innovation, entrepreneurship. How do you respond to those arguments?
Well, you know, the book is an empirical book in many ways. It's not a book of theory. There's good economic theory that leaves a place for government, public goods, market failures, information economics, and so forth. But they're ambiguous. How much government is a wide open question. But the fact is that big governments, if we compare countries with big governments and high taxes to ourselves, there is no serious, consistent basis for saying that they grew more slowly than we, or that they're less productive than we are. None whatsoever. That doesn't mean that big government leads to more growth, but it does mean that big government doesn't prevent growth. That means big government, if done well, must provide social goods and public goods and regulations that help some other countries grow. And then look at our history, as I described before. Government has been there all the way. And there's one other empirical fact. When this anti-government attitude ascended in America in the 1970s, how well has the American economy done since then? Not very well at all, except for the Clinton boom of the late 1990s. Take that out. We've had a fairly miserable performance, especially measured in terms of wages for typical people.
So do you think that we are now at a turning point? I mean, is the case coming back, the case that you would like to make coming back because of this crisis, because of this serious recession that we seem to be entering?
We're clearly at some kind of turning point, but I'm not convinced it will be long-lasting necessarily. The harsh reality is it depends on the depth of the crisis. The deeper the crisis, the more there will be reforms, and ironically, the better off we'll be in the long run. That doesn't mean we won't make some useful changes. But will we do all that's necessary? Because of this ideology, we have an enormously long to-do list in America, the most important part of which is health care. Extraordinarily inefficient in America. But there are many other issues. Poor infrastructure, lack of internet penetration, lack of green technologies, no pre-K system. College is very expensive, even when you subtract college aid from it and so forth. We have an awful lot to contend with. Are we? Can I really be optimistic that we are? I am only optimistic we're going to begin to move in that direction. And it's up to the president-elect, President Obama-to-be, to adopt programs that work and demonstrate to the American people that government can be useful. Government's not the problem, and can make us all better in a fair way. And then maybe we can build from there.
You say it's a long list of things to do, but we do really need to have some kind of prioritization here, don't we, it seems to me?
You know, my sense of Obama is he's going to, because of the crisis, he's going to try to attack a lot of issues at one time. Before the crisis, I think there would have been a priority, maybe on health care, maybe one or two other things. I think he's going to try to attack a lot of things separately, but I would like to see a priority on health care and pre-K education, and also in attitudes about wages, because wages in America are in a crisis. For men, they just haven't gone up for many, many years. The typical male makes less now than the typical male did after inflation 30 or 40 years ago.
I was going to say, how significant do you think the issue of inequality in the United States is? It seems to be very high compared with most comparator countries in Europe and Asia.
Yeah,
is that one of the real central problems, do you think, with this society, with this economy?
Well, I'll sound a little bit contrary on this issue. I don't think inequality is exactly the issue, because incomes can grow unequally, but the middle and the bottom can still rise, just the top rise more quickly. In America, we've had the top rise very quickly, and the middle and the bottom have grown almost not at all, stagnated this way. We've got a wage stagnation issue. Now, inequality is part of it, but you know, in a certain sense, in an arithmetic sense, we just solved the inequality problem. The upper end has collapsed. When you start looking at the statistics, you're going to say, whoa, we're back to the early 70s here in income distribution. That won't solve the problem. The problem is getting wages up for the large majority of people from, say, the 60th percentile down.
What kind of transition do you think you could see? I mean, presumably you would never see a United States that was like Sweden, where 50% of GDP is in taxation and public spending. But where would you see America progressing to in an ideal world?
We could easily have 3-5% of GDP devoted to government programs like the ones we're discussing without undermining our productivity, as demonstrated by the fact that Sweden has 15% more and Norway has 15% more, and they do quite well. Norway in particular, but Sweden does quite well, and so do other countries in continental Europe. 3-5% more of GDP is a heck of a lot of money, $450 to $750 billion more a year, with which we can deal with healthcare, we can deal with infrastructure, and we've got to. It's not an outrageous amount of money. We've got to start thinking in those terms. We should raise taxes to do it.
And that's the hardest thing to do, though, isn't it? I mean, is it
really hard right now.
For a politician to say, I'm going to raise taxes in this country,
really
is out of the question, isn't it?
There's a good chance, I don't know when this is coming out, but there's a good chance the Obama stimulus plan will be very heavy on tax cuts to try to win over the Republicans and some of the conservative Democrats to push this thing through. We need tax cuts like a hole in the head. I'm not saying raise taxes now, needless to say, because we've got a very serious recession. We shouldn't be raising taxes, maybe not even on the upper income people. But down the road, we got to raise taxes. I mean, not a lot. We're not, you know, 3-4% per person, 5% per person. We're not talking about a lot of money here, and we can make our lives so much better if we do that.
Final question, Jeff. How much do you think is in the power of the president? Because it seems to me a lot of the issue with the United States is it's such a decentralized country relative to the kind of European welfare states that you're talking about, and so much more power is down at local level, city level, state level.
Yeah.
Well, what can President Obama, when he takes office, do?
Well, he's in a great position now because he's popular. We have a crisis. The nation is behind him. So he has more power than usual. I think presidents have great powers of persuasion. They have access to the press. They are not like prime ministers because Congress, right now, President-elect Obama, as we speak, is having trouble with the Democrats in Congress, not just the Republicans. So we do move more slowly. But this is a point in time where this man can move rapidly, and he's intellectually and emotionally capable of it. That's not to say I love all his appointees by any means, and I'm worried about them, both in foreign policy and economic policy. But he is a special person. Having said that, there are inhibitions in the American political system, restrictions that make it hard to move too rapidly, too far. But, you know, we've done great things in America before. We haven't done everything we needed to do. We haven't done them in time all the time. But we have done great things.
Jeff Madrick, thank you very much.